Welcome to The Sustainable Life. This is Josh Spodek, and I'm here with Erica Frank, MD, MPH, lots of degrees. And I'm going to share how, first of all, how are you doing, Erica?
I'm doing great. Delighted to be here with you, Josh. Thanks.
And we've just been chatting before recording, and we're definitely going to run out of time on this call. But I'm going to share how we connected is that I do a lot of stuff with Flight Free USA, not having flown for some time. And they had, we had a year-end call that was also, I guess it was really folded into a group that is working on helping academia lower its flying and various other forms of impact. You were there and we met. And actually, you called me out on one thing of I was talking about, we were talking about what we were going to do the following year. And last year, someone I spoke to had committed to not flying and pledged on Flight Free USA's page. And I said, all right, I'm going to get five in 2024. If I got one last year, I'm going to get five next year. And I got all five in January.
Yes.
So I was really excited about that. And then contacted you because you said, well, it's not just individual action. And I think we both agree that individual action is important. Systemic change begins with personal change.
Yes.
And so you've been working in academia, which I see as a recalcitrant area. You are very accomplished. And I really wanted to hear what you're doing, what your background is that led you to this, how it's been. And then that's what I thought before we spoke, just like 10 minutes ago. And then you also shared about how your experience is 1993, so that's 30 years ago, and that are very relevant to me. So I hope we get to that too.
Sounds wonderful.
I guess to begin with, could you give some background on what brought you to, I guess, academics and then to take a lead role in sustainability?
Well, I guess it's more that I never left academe. I graduated from high school when I was 15 and had a really exciting time in the Honors and Independent Studies program at Smith and just got the bug of this being, I grew up in Princeton as well. My mother was the chair of her Department of Education at the community college where she taught. And I guess for me, the nexus between Sustainable Development Goals 3 and 4 around education and health became so clear that education and research in an educational academic environment is the most exciting and important thing I think I certainly could do with my life. So, and doing that at scale, which comes back to why I called you out, is what was particularly intriguing to me. So that's that, because if being a good doctor is about helping one person be healthier, then being a great doctor for me could be about helping many, many people be healthier. So yeah, that's, I think, the nutshell version of what took me down that path.
Is for you, when I got my PhD, well, there was a lot of grunt work in there. But I think from the outside, a lot of academia looks academic.
Yes.
And kind of from an outsider's perspective, I can see why they might think it's boring and not very exciting. To me, curiosity being such a huge part of me, I think most people also. And there's this childlike wonder of the universe. I mean, I was in physics and astrophysics. Was it something like that for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and still every day. I'm sitting right now in a windowed loft on Grouse Mountain in Vancouver. And the windows look out onto Douglas fir and cedar, and it's 8:12 in the morning here. So they're just being early March. They're being kissed by morning sun finally. And I did something extraordinary in this room. Part of what I enjoy in my rather, I guess, renaissance, if you want to be charitable, interests is design and interior design. I just got my, as I mentioned, my fourth academic appointment at UBC in architecture and landscape architecture. And I decorated this room with the most beautiful light bulb I've ever seen, two of them. It's LED, of course, but then it has this cast but misshapen light bulb around it. So it's very organic, but also highly technical looking. And then I trimmed some trees and bushes and brought them inside and spray painted them with glow in the dark paint, parts of them that were clearly dead, and decorated the room with them. And so now this room is alive with lit trees 24 hours a day, illuminated through the energy coming through those windows and through the 95% clean energy that we now have in British Columbia, 92%, I think, of which at this point is hydro. So that's kind of the ecosystem that results from this in a very physical way, that expression of curiosity and wonder and delight in how can we use science and all of the tools that we've developed to be able to improve our world.
Yeah, what besides the words that you said, the tone, the emotion resonates with something that I struggle to communicate to people who consistently think that because I'm not flying and I'm off the grid, then I must be depriving myself.
Yeah, hair shirting.
And I keep saying, yeah, that, and even my mom says, it's good that you say things like that, even though you don't really feel it. You and Greta have to say things like that so that other people will follow, even though it's miserable. She doesn't say even though it's miserable, but she implies it.
Yes.
And the way I usually put it is I'm a kid playing with Lego, like figuring out, like my, I now have to say, you might have seen this in my blog post, I think yesterday, was that the pressure cooker is the most, well, raw is the most efficient way to eat stuff, but I've been cooking with a big pressure cooker, like 6-quart. And when I plugged into the wall, it didn't matter. It would just power. But when I'm climbing up and down the stairs to get the solar, then I don't want to use, I want to conserve energy. In my case, I'm not polluting with it. I mean, I am because I'm wearing down the equipment a bit, but I got a smaller pressure cooker. I'm going to sell a bigger pressure cooker. So I'm not buying extra stuff, I'm trading it.
Nice.
And it uses less energy because Q equals MC delta T. There's less mass. It's so fun.
Yes. Yes. It is figuring out, being competent enough to understand and be able to follow the rules and then be able to say, well, how can we move a little to the side of that? So this comes up certainly in so many of the realms that we're interested in talking about. Maybe I'll start with housing and then maybe we can talk a little about flying. But I too have been having an unusual housing life for quite some time, from co-designing, co-building and living in and owning the only energy independent home in Georgia in 1993. To living in co-housing in Atlanta, and then living on campus at the University of British Columbia, where I'm a prof, and came in 2006. And the half a year after I came to UBC, I got appointed to the University Neighborhood Association board and served 3 terms, 6 years, and helped design a whole bunch of buildings on campus, including housing. And the latest project, as of last week, is that we are going to be creating a co-housing. This is the first public discussion of that, where we will be doing more experimenting with campus as a living lab and figuring out how to use an academic environment and campus as a living lab to allow our curiosity to permeate every aspect of our lives and our research. So I'm going to be the principal investigator on this, and I think it's going to be a way to use the observation of our activities of daily living to understand how to better promote peace and community and well-being for everyone globally. So yeah, I think that well-played, an academic environment can produce that kind of nest for stimulated and important world-changing thinking.
Can I go back a step to where, when I talk to most academics, or also most people, about changing things, they tend to, or I would say restoring sustainability, they often throw up their hands in futility, and they, like at NYU where I teach, I constantly get told, look at how much we're already doing. We're one of the good guys.
Yeah.
And it's various forms of resistance. And was there a story of, did you once face that? Did you feel that way yourself? And was there something that transitioned you? Or are you just like, I'm going to do this no matter what, and I'm going to make it work? How did it begin? Was there a beginning?
Yeah, well, I'll give two examples. First, nextgenu.org, and then I'll talk about flying. So nextgenu.org, I thought of the idea for it in 2001, and the idea was democratizing education using the technologies that had emerged. MOOCs hadn't been announced yet, weren't to be announced for another 7 years, but this was essentially the idea of a MOOC that I proposed in 2001, curating existing resources that were posted on the web from high quality sources into degrees, were now being used in every country in the world through half of US med schools with a full free curriculum from first grade to PhD available to anyone in the world. And I was told by my boss's boss, etc., since I invented it in 2001, that, you know, at the two academic institutions where I was, that this was not of interest for me to be pursuing the development of this. So I moved here to UBC and started studying it instead of doing intervention research on it, and hired a CEO, a remarkable person who has helped grow this organization considerably. And yeah, so that's how I got the Canada Research Chair to be able to do this study. So yeah, it was extreme clarity for me, Josh, that this was a way, like I said, to address Sustainable Development Goals 3 and 4, education and health, that being able to produce free education globally would be a very powerful way to improve both of those, along with a whole lot of other SDGs. So that was that bulldozing. I'll morph to flying, or do you want to ask a follow-up question on that?
Well, it felt like you... All right, I know that there's a Nobel Prize somewhere in there. And did that give you leeway or foundation to persist past people saying there's no interest? Or I don't know the timing on things.
Yeah. So I am the custodian of one of the commemorative medals of the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize that was given to the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. And I was the president of IPPNW's U.S. affiliate, Physicians for Social Responsibility, in 2008, and on the board for a decade before that, and co-refounded, revitalized IPPNW Canada a few years ago, and I'm on the board here, and I'm on the board of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War globally as well, which was the original recipient. So those are all the organizations that earned that. I carry that around and bring it out for Peacenik activities where it inspires people. I'm glad to provide it for folks if they're interested. So yeah, that's the association with that. And it was for our work on nukes. Now, Physicians for Social Responsibility works on both nukes and on climate change as the two primary areas. And IPPNW Canada, of course, still works primarily on nuclear.
By any chance, do you know Seth Sheldon, who's been a guest on this podcast from ICANW?
I know lots of folks from ICANN, but not Seth, no.
Okay. And when he said you bring it out sometimes, I got to share the story because he used to live like two blocks away from me.
Yes.
And I didn't know that when I was contacting him. And one time we ran into each other on 6th Avenue and we're just talking. And after we recorded, he's come over here for dinner and stuff like that. And we're chatting. And it turns out he does community theater. And a woman walked up who recognized him in his community theater group who didn't know about his Nobel Prize. And like I kind of alluded to it. And it was clear that she didn't know about it. And I hinted to him, like, can I tell her about it? And he's like, sure. And so I tell him, she's like, wow. And he goes, by the way, I happen to have it on me right now. And he gets it out of his bag, and we're standing on 6th Avenue, like passing this Nobel Prize back and forth. People walking by, so I took pictures of it. So
yeah, it is a magical object, and I am actually working with IPPNW now to figure out how we can best leverage that magic. Yeah.
All right, so I wanted to see how that fit into things. I imagine it does give you some leeway that you're using.
No.
Okay.
Modest. I mean, it is part what I think probably many of your guests share is an accumulation of visible competencies and credentials. And so, sure, it adds to that, sure.
All right, so let's jump to flying.
Yeah.
Because that's a big piece of, especially in academia, I feel like professors aren't paid tons, but they love to travel. My dad was a history professor, and he traveled all the time, and he never had to pay for it.
Yes. Yeah.
So you took it on.
Yeah.
You're taking it on.
Yes. So, well, I saw this graph in 2013, and it kind of ruined air travel for me. I mean, I've traveled to 70 countries, some of them since then, but I travel 15%, maybe something like that, of what I used to do. I saw this graph, and if maybe you could post it in one of your blogs sometime in concert with publishing this.
Is it?
It showed that all of the other stuff that I did was irrelevant compared to a single flight. That a single flight would be 10 times, for example, the average yearly carbon footprint of someone even in Europe, and maybe 30 times that of someone in India or in Africa. And I saw that, I was like, oh no, because I obviously love traveling, having done so much of it, and have friends and family all over the world. But it was like, I saw the graph, and I felt like I had no choice, that if I wanted to be like at all serious as an environmentalist, that was really what I had to concentrate on, both for me personally, but then to scale it, because it was clear to me that everything that my academic and other, you know, bright, noisily, virtue signalingly green colleagues and friends were doing paled in comparison to their air travel. And so I've been on a, you know, it's not a very popular thing to talk about, to be clear, but I've been on a campaign since then, and got the University of British Columbia's Board of Governors, along with lots of other people, to pass a policy saying that by 2030, that we will reduce our work-related air travel by 50% compared to pre-pandemic, pre-2019 levels.
Now, to me, you remind me of when, for me, that revelation was, I was actually on a flight watching a video. I don't know if you know David McKay. He's since passed, but he wrote this book, Sustainability Without the Hot Air, where he tried to understand and tried to clarify, put in human terms what effects things had. And one of the things he said, so he's British, so he said a round-trip flight, London to Los Angeles, round-trip coach, polluted roughly a year's worth of driving. And until then, I knew that flying polluted, but I figured it was, actually, I think I wanted to believe it was kind of like driving a car. Like one flight would kind of be like taking a drive somewhere. But I think I knew that it was significantly more, and so did not deliberately, like, kept myself willfully ignorant. And then it hit me. And so that was flying home from someplace. The next flight I took, I had a feeling like you did, but I was like, well, what can I do though? And I just could not sleep the next flight I took. And I said, all right, this is it. I can't, no more flying. So I challenged myself to go for a year without flying at the time and thought that it would be a really terrible year. And it was the opposite, that I found, well, I don't want to talk too much about my stuff because probably listeners have heard it before, but did you feel like deprivation and sacrifice?
No, I want to talk about that hair shirt stuff, right? Uh-huh. So
yeah,
it is. I think that this need for it to feel monastic, for it to be properly virtuous, is a big barrier to a lot of people to doing anything. And to doing things that are meaningful. So, you know, I spent years trying to be vegan, like really strictly, like honey is okay, but pretty much everything else not. And I just was unsuccessful and ended up like doing incredibly embarrassing things to cover up my failure to be to do this really simple activity. But I have still since then eaten low on the food chain and ethically. And same thing with flying. It was clear that I couldn't deny these facts anymore about how much more important flying was than anything else that I was doing. And Visual Carbon is the website that people can go to if they can't wait to see the data. And the flying versus everything else for 1 year is the graph you want to look at. It's above the fold on the homepage. So yeah, I think just facing up to the fact that you're recycling and taking the bus and eating less red meat and all of, and buying green power, like all, and buying an electric car, all of these things that all of us who care about this stuff do are great and important things for us to do as an individual. But the societal change that has to happen is that we have to all fly less. And those of us who often are in the luxurious state of being able to care about our carbon footprints are typically among the very small percent of the world that flies at all, and that also even that flies the most. So you don't have to be vegan about flying though. I mean, I admire that you do, and I admire I have a couple other friends who do as well, but like, I'm pretty proud of cutting down by 85% and still having a really rich professional life where I physically visit colleagues and have meaningful time with them and reciprocated. But I do push them to do things by video, and I do push to have more meetings by video, and people are receptive. So yeah, that's kind of my story on that, Josh.
I'm glad you picked up on the how it's presented to others and how people perceive it and how we perceive it ourselves. Because at the beginning, I mean, I knew the science for a long time without acting. And the reason I didn't act was that I expected it to be that it would make my life worse and there'd be no point. Even after I did a couple things, it was only when I started experimenting. I did lots of experiments that never really clicked, but then some started clicking, especially avoiding packaged food. That was like the first big one where I was pleasantly surprised that, well, I had to learn to cook from scratch.
Yeah, I noticed your absence of trash. Very impressive.
And that was, it's, when I first started avoiding packaged food, I was not able to get takeout and the easy stuff from the store, like hummus and baba ganoush and things like that. But it wasn't long before I was cooking from scratch, saving money and eating much more delicious, much more varied, getting to know the farmers at the farmer's market and how to get free food from them, and also how to get farmer's markets to areas where farmer's markets don't exist, because that's a major issue for a lot of people, access. And only when I started enjoying it, up until then, I felt like, well, there's this message out there. We have to give stuff up. We have to sacrifice, because basically implying life is so good, but we have to make it not so good. And it's kind of, we have to. But I couldn't share that message. Only when I found these surprisingly rewarding experiences could I, like, I teach leadership. So leadership is a lot about intrinsic motivation, not extrinsic. And only when I realized there's something that people can find joy in here, everyone. Like, it's very tempting, I think, for people to say, well, Josh is just like that. He's some weirdo. Well, these are really basic human things,
yeah,
of community and family that we get more of. And
yeah,
that switch from focusing on legislation or technological development or market incentives to intrinsic motivation, that to me is, that's how you get ideas to spread, as opposed to having to push all the time.
Yeah, I think it's also important, like you're kind of making a career out of your delight in this. I think it's important for your listeners to know, again, that like it doesn't have to be a career. They don't have to go vegan, right? That if they could make a substantial change in just their flying and get people around them to make just that substantial change, that would, by decreasing your flying by half, you will decrease your carbon footprint by practically that amount as well. Flying, if you do a substantial amount of it, is practically all of your carbon footprint. It is so generative. And generative, of course, as many of your listeners might know, at altitude, where the water vapor as well serves as a greenhouse gas and causes even more damage than carbon emitted at ground level. So yeah, there are, if you have to pick one thing, flying less is it. If you care about a personal action that will make a difference in the immediate term while we're getting all this other stuff figured out to do long term, flying less is the action that will have the biggest effect on your carbon footprint.
And I'm going to throw in, you mentioned carbon. I'm also going to throw in that people are displaced from their homes and their cultures are displaced from their land to get at the minerals and resources underneath. And there's deforestation. It's not just, I mean, as if climate, yes, might be enough, but it's many other things, especially to get that fuel. And
yes,
it's like we will do anything to get it.
Yeah. And, you know, it feels a little icky, but to be talking about the joy of this when we're also talking, of course, about the prevention of suffering through this, but it is like being able to actually feel like you're doing something meaningful to make other people's lives less painful when you so much, like it really does have an inherent good. But also, I have, for example, been living out of a knapsack since last May. So for 9-ish months now, and couch surfing primarily. And it has been amazing. And again, feels a little like, oh, aren't I wonderful? I have this great privilege of being able to do this because I have friends who have a space. But how has it been incredible in terms of building community with those friends and being able to enjoy decorating a home with glow-in-the-dark flowers that I leave behind as a legacy, and it's not more stuff that's brought to the world to serve me. It's trimmings from the garden and a little paint. So yeah, I have found enormous joy in this community of people who care about the community of people and being able to find ways to collectively raise all ships without it being a result of higher water levels.
Now, I can't tell. 4 academic appointments tells me you're something like in your 60s. But the thing with the light bulbs tells me you're probably 10 years old. And the backpacking around tells me you're in your 20s.
That's very kind. Yeah, I had 4 academic appointments at Emory also when I was in my 30s. But yeah, I'm 61. And I have, I used to have this tone be ascribed to youthful enthusiasm. I think that's no longer attributable. But yeah, the attitude about an incredibly cool light bulb, and I'll send you a picture of it along with the glow-in-the-dark hydrangea to add to your post if you'd like. I think you'll be excited about it too. I think your listeners will as well.
Now, I want to not leave the flying and the not hair shirt. Oh, I have to also throw in about vegan. So I happen to not like meat. So it's not like that was, it's partly for environmental reasons, but it's also just because I don't want it.
Yes.
But when I watch, one of the big things about my steps toward living more sustainably is I keep learning about other cultures that live more sustainably, especially, I mean, I've had guests on the program, on the show, who have lived among the Hadza in Tanzania, the San in Southern Africa, the Tsumane along the Amazon, the Matses in Peru, the Kogi in Colombia. And I could fly to go visit those places. I could even sail to visit those places. But I don't feel like they've invited me to go there. But I'm learning more about them by living, by trying to learn from, I'm not trying to be like them, except to restore some of the values that we seem to have lost of stewardship and this joy of nature. And I feel like I'm actually connecting more with a lot of the places that when I flew around a lot, I would have wanted to fly to visit, but I think I would have helped undermine their cultures. In any case, learning about them hunting, I saw this great movie called The Great Dance about the San Bushmen in Southern Africa, and it traces them. I don't know how they did the camera work, but them hunting, and you know, they're having barbecues, and I'm like, I like that idea. I think I would enjoy that if I were not in my current culture, which would not do so sustainably. Anyway, I want to switch to, I want to not leave that, but also get back to your 1993 living, because we started talking about that before recording, and I feel like there's overlap in the joy of it. And also, I'm very curious to hear, I mean, I could just go on Craigslist and get some solar panels and batteries that were used and start using them and discover that it worked, but that these things weren't available then. What was it like for you then?
Well,
if I didn't say too much, I mean,
no, that's good. I'll respond to that last question first, and then you can bring me into other pieces to respond as you'd like. I made up a little, I am an eco-pioneer. I think it's fun and somewhat queer. Yeah. And it went on from there. It was an odd queer thing to do back then to create an energy independent home. As I said, it was the only one in Georgia. And it was, well, I love problem solving. And once I thought of the idea of, could we be totally energy independent in this ecosystem that, you know, gets quite cold, lots of snow on the ground in winter because it was at altitude in the mountains in Georgia and gets quite hot, of course, in the summer. And so I designed the basics of the heating and cooling systems, and that was so much fun to get to do. And as I mentioned, it, you know, this kind of exploration led to now having an appointment in the School of Architecture and Landscape Architecture. And it is, these are all of a piece of being someone who decided to dedicate her life to health that and well-being, that how those hunters appealed to you, Josh, was because that was what our sociobiologic drive for prospect and refuge have driven people toward for millennia. And the difficulty, of course, is that our sociobiologic drives to prospect and refuge have completely different rules now for many people in the world, certainly for the half of people in the world who live in an urban environment. So we're all just trying to figure out how to invent this new kind of life in a way that's sustainable. To circle back, just in case anybody missed the point, the most important thing to do is to enjoy your life in the place where you are and not fly to somebody else, someplace else. But yeah, I think that it is not easy to figure out how to achieve prospect and refuge, the two main things we're biologically driven toward, in an environment where you can acquire as much as you want and even more.
It reminds me of an image I have of today's world is someone sitting on a beach scrolling through their phone at pictures of other beaches wishing they were there.
Yeah.
All right, so can we go back to 1993? Because I'm curious if you faced, to me, the interface with other people is the challenge, because people all want to see what they want to see, or they see what they want to see and not what I'm experiencing. And so the communication with others is a challenge. Did you face that? Or did any stories of challenges you overcame or frustrations or, I don't know, or maybe joys, maybe something I can learn from?
Yeah, I think that something that you and I share that is probably a reason why your listeners listen to you is saying, okay, I'm wanting to work with other people on this, but yeah, I have this idea that I think I can do on my own. And so, and I really think this would be fun and exciting to try and then to let other people know about it. So yeah, we were on CNN the half a dozen times with the house. There was an article, bunch of articles on it in various media. There was like picking things. And again, air travel is one of them that you can do yourself that will make a difference and that can set an example for other people that when scaled will make an enormous difference. It is really gratifying to be able to figure out a solution and try it at whatever scale your time and wallet can afford.
I'm just delighted in, you said delight earlier, and I haven't been using that word, and it really, there's a lot of delight in this, especially in finding someone like you who, we don't approach things exactly the same, but there's a joy, a rewarding emotional response.
Uh-huh.
That even with a lot of environmentalists, I get a lot of like, we have to, not yes. we get to.
Yeah.
And I want to share this because I think many people, if they didn't hear us, would think this conversation would be impossible. Like,
yeah,
we'd have to strategize about how to get this bitter pill down instead of actually like, this is fun.
Yeah. And it's also ironic too, because I think that this goes back to the reason why environmentalists get called out on flying to conferences, because like that's one of the things that a lot of us consider fun still, right? Is going to conferences, meeting people who you care about, like-minded, who, you know, and who provide sustenance for the in-between times. So I think that, yeah, figuring out how to communicate the joy of this even to our most dour colleagues who are rewarded only on the rare occasions when they do allow themselves a flight, that could be quite productive as well.
One of the things so I do these workshops where I lead people through learning the Spodek method, which is a leadership technique to evoke emotions of how people feel when they connect with nature and to act on those emotions, which are generally rewarding. They're things like awe and inspiration and family, or oftentimes this feeling of like, I'm so tiny and yet that makes what I do so meaningful.
Huh.
And so this woman, Evelyn, who took the workshop last spring and then in the summer was the TA, and then this past session she led, and she was in the workshop. She was like, I don't have any background in science. I don't know. I haven't done any sustainability stuff. I'm far behind everyone. But you don't have to know a lot of science and you don't have to have a lot of experience to do, you know, what you were saying is like, find something you like. And she describes it as like, this is what I've been looking for my entire life. And she and I have been talking about doing live streams of just talking about after the mindset shift of acting not because we have to, but because we get to.
Huh.
And I think it would be interesting for people to hear, not like political strategy. I mean, that stuff may be important. I'm not saying not to do these things, but not like, how do we market this? How do we get this? But like, what's it like? It's fun.
Yes.
Like she,
yes.
I don't know if you saw the video a little while ago. She's in Eastern Oregon and she has just almost totally switched to riding her bike. And she's doing this video of herself riding a bike in the snow with a trailer on the back.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw that one. And I assumed, since she referred to herself as a mommy in it as well, that, yeah, she was trailering her child in the back. Yeah, that's fabulous.
Yeah. And like, there's no way I could have said to her, here's what you should do. You should start riding your bike in the snow. And if somehow I got her to and she complied because I convinced her to,
she would not have been grinning like she was in that video, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And she wasn't even doing that for propaganda. She said, I mean, I don't know if you know, the resolution was really low because she just did it on her phone and sent it to me and she didn't even know how to get it off her phone. So I was like, do you mind if I post this online? She was like, yeah, I was trying to figure out how. And she's just sharing fun. She's not trying to get people to do anything with it. And can we get more of that? You know, I came into this call anticipating talking about how like movements for academics to fly less, but now I'm really enjoying riffing on the joy and the delight.
Yeah, me too. And just to tell you, my response to the video was thinking about last Friday when I rode my bike in the snow in Vancouver and didn't have to, wasn't quite as thick as hers, wasn't a couple inches, but was, you know, blizzarding pretty reasonably as I was riding. And it was so much fun to like be competent enough at riding my bike that I could do it on streets and then in the woods on the path on the way home. And it was so cool to be able to do that and to know that I don't, like in Vancouver, I don't need to have a car. I don't have a car at this moment in life, and I have an electric bike and I have an incredible transit system, and there's Moto and Evo and other car rental services and friends who schlep me places, but it's wonderful not having to deal with the car. I'm so glad. When I lived in New York City, where you are now, I moved there from Cleveland with two cars and within a month had gotten rid of it. It, of course, is the paragon of North American not needing a car virtue, right? But yeah, even in Vancouver and lots of other places now, being able to experience the joy of not having to deal with a vehicle is a non-trivial joy.
I'm going to share a really weird, I think it's unusual, but in retrospect, normal. So I pick up litter every day. So I'm constantly, when I'm walking around.
Yes, I saw that too. And it was something else I resonated with. Sorry to interrupt you. Yes, I love that. And I do so as well. Go ahead. Sorry.
No apology necessary, because we're riffing on joy.
Yes.
And now, pick up litter doesn't actually reduce the amount of litter in the world. It reduces the amount of litter, but not the amount of garbage. It just saves it from going to the ocean as quickly, but it will still get there eventually. But the big thing about picking up litter is that it leads me to not buy things that could produce litter because of the disgust that I feel picking up all the stuff. Like yesterday, I went to Washington Square Park. No, sorry, Sunday. And it was the first, okay, it's early March and the temperature was 67 degrees. I don't know what that is, Celsius, but, you know, warm, shorts weather. And every garbage bin in Washington Square Park was overflowing. It took garbage like around it because everyone's like, oh, let's go to the park. And where they maybe once might have chopped up some fruit and brought some fruit salad, they just go to the store and pick up their packaged baba ganoush and hummus, as I did too. You know, anyway, so I'm picking up litter all the time. And as it turns out, I pick up a lot of Metro cards, which is the thing you swipe to get into the subway.
Yes, yes.
And so yesterday there was this thing out in Brooklyn and I was delighted that I used this 2-trip Metro card that I found that had both trips on it. I haven't paid for a subway trip in years just because I keep finding these Metro cards with money on them. And that's even giving them away because there was a monthly one, which is worth $100 or so, that I just found on the ground. And like, I'd return it, but what? It's just sitting there. So I had to give that to a friend who rides the subway every day because I don't ride the subway enough. But it's fun. It's like, it's not riding my bike. It's not as fun as riding my bike, but it's delightful.
It is, you know. One could even envision it as a treasure hunt. I'd not really thought about it this way before, but I actually, one of my other interior design things is I make lighting from found objects. And I've done so with, I guess the biggest piece of trash that I found that I turned into a lamp was a plow. On campus at UBC, a piece of a plow. It used to be farmland here.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it is fun to take garden clippings and turn them into glow-in-the-dark art. It is fun to turn a plowshare into a lamp. Yeah.
I'm just delighted. Do you think that we're onto something with people who have switched and found this joy and delight to share? Like, do you think people believe that it's possible? I'm predisposed to believe that of the American public, I would guess well over 95% would think the feelings that we experience are the opposite of what they would get. But I'm not sure. Maybe I'm too jaded.
So here's what I'm doing next to promote this notion that being green can be fun. So as of Friday, as I mentioned, we are, it looks like, going ahead with building a large co-housing at UBC. And this is the very, 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 very beginning stages of working on and talking about it. But the idea is that we will study how to build community and how to have governance and how to have interactions that promote sustainability that is triple bottom line sustainability. So UBC is usually ranked in the top 5 in terms of sustainability and universities globally, but there are two things that we really haven't done yet. Well, one is the air travel piece, and we're working on that. And the second is thinking about how to do different forms of housing that allow for triple bottom line sustainability. So for financial, economic, and social sustainability. And I think we've done a good job of modeling how two people who an hour ago were strangers had talked on a conference call a couple months ago only managed to find such joy in discovering another person who truly cares about what the world is going to be like for future people and other creatures, and who has good ideas for how to ensure or at least promote the likelihood that that'll happen. So there is inherent joy in that, and we are going to build that community and study it and figure out how to extrapolate it to the world. That's one of the things that I want to do next, to be able to answer that question about how to co-cultivate joy in a more sustainable, triple bottom line sustainable ecosystem.
Well, I hope that you'll come back for another episode, even if it's just free form. I'm going to share with you, I'm geeky, so I'm going to talk about nerdy stuff.
Good.
The word dialogue.
Uh-huh.
Do you know, I'd learned this recently, that the word, I thought monologue is one person speaking, so dialogue is two people speaking. It turns out that it's not die as in two, it's dia as in flow, like diagram.
Oh, huh.
And dialogue is a flow of words. It's like, usually I try to keep track of if I digress, I should return back to the original thing. But a dialogue is just kind of letting it flow.
Yes.
And I would love to engage in more dialogue with you.
Oh, of
if
course.
You game.
Yes, of course. Yeah, this is, I hope that this has proven intriguing for your listeners and hopefully a little delightful for your listeners as well. And I would love to, doing these kinds of activities is about building that network of joyful environmentalists, of bright, joyous green people. So yes, please let me know when I can next be helpful in that way. Thank you, Josh.
So I look forward to speaking again. And before wrapping, you had mentioned community a few times. And I was curious if you have experienced what I have, which is the bigger the challenge on sustainability, the more that I find when I solve it, I connect with people and create community in a really joyful way, usually ways that I could not have predicted. I wonder if that's something you've built into the house. Is that an expectation you have with housing? And are you expecting it? Is it something that, can you share a bit more about community and housing and your expectations?
Yeah, having lived in co-housing for many years, it's guaranteed. I mean, it really, when I went to my first meal at the co-housing where we lived for 7 years, I left and I got into the car with my husband and I started crying. And he said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "We have to move." And it was like, it was this huge feeling of joy and of like, and with a little bit of annoyance, right? Because we just moved into this house and we had a new baby and we just done all these renovations. But it was so clear to me that this was a way to be able to have the privacy that one needs, the refuge one needs to be able to do work and all the other functions one needs one's own space for. And the prospect of being able to interact with other human beings who cared about community and who were explicitly acknowledging the fact that community is important to human health and well-being. I mean, it's evident when you look at animals, and we're definitely animals in that way. So there's lots of evidence on that. So yeah, that's what community for me is based both on the scientific data and on the fact that I went to a dinner left and sobbed in the car because I knew I had to move there.
Well, I can't wait until next time we speak. Erica Frank, thank you very much, in particular for bringing this delight. I know for the next week or so, delight is going to be on my mind, and I'm going to be like picking up on it more than I would have otherwise.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. It was indeed delightful for me as well, and I look forward to more. Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you.
How many people are bringing a message of joy from what everyone calls saving the environment, but I call the future? Step by step, this podcast is creating a culture of joy, community, and connection around sharing and acting on our environmental values. Again, there's no profit in buying and wasting less, but we'll all love our lives and relationships more when we do. I can use your support. Please donate at joshuaspodek.com/donate. Again, that's joshuaspodek.com/donate.